originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who took Derby 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pradnik come again to beat He's Had Enough.
Raji Baraj aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano. A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm your host, retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I'm joining you tonight from our Jimmy John's of Lexington, Kentucky studio. I'd like to thank everyone listening tonight on Sirius 219, XM 201, and also to those of you tuning into our website at horseracingradio.net. A portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial assistance to riders who have suffered devastating on-track injuries. If you are able to help, please visit their website at www.pdjf.org. So our guest this evening, she got started in 1985 when she won her first race at Suffolk Downs. And she went on to win multiple leading rider titles at Suffolk and is a 3-time recipient of the Eli Chiat Memorial Outstanding Jockey Award. She was inducted into the New England Hall of Fame in 2014. She's the 3rd leading female jockey of all time with 2,519 wins and over $25 million in earnings. It's an honor to introduce jockey Tammy Pamarini. Tammy, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Christina. It's an honor to be asked to be on the show. How are you today?
I am doing great. I am very excited about this show, Tammy. You and I rode together 9 years ago, I think it was, at Suffolk Downs.
Wow, it's been that long.
It's been a long time.
Seems like yesterday, Christine.
It really does, and obviously we have a lot to talk about with the closing of Suffolk Downs this past Sunday. Breaks my heart. I'm sure it does the same to you. What was it like riding there the final weekend at Suffolk?
It was a crazy weekend, you know. A lot of mixed emotions came out from everybody, not just me. I mean, everybody. If you were there, Kristen, you'd be in awe because you couldn't move in the joint. There was not a parking spot around. Everybody elbow to elbow. A lot of tears, a lot of smiles. You know, it's sad celebration.
I really wanted to make it out there myself.
A lot of memories made there.
I can't imagine the emotion you had to feel. 34 years, you called that place home.
Oh, that's home. My own little family, actually big family. I'm from New England, so it's even more home. And when we had to leave and try to make route somewhere else, you know what they say, no place like home. So every time we'd go back to ride there, it's that feeling you get, and, you know, it's relaxing, and it's good to be home.
Well, let's talk about hopefully the future is somewhat bright for area racing there in New England. I heard rumors about Fair Circuit. What are they talking about now?
Well, I don't know how sure. I don't know if it's a sure thing, but there is talk about Great Barrington next year. That would be nice. And, you know, there's other talk about gentlemen wanting to build a racetrack somewhere in Massachusetts. So to me, if they can find somewhere or someplace to run, I would be elated.
It's not Suffolk, and hopefully we do see that develop. And but what was it about Suffolk that initially drew your attention? Obviously, you were from the area, but you started out there. You won your first race at Suffolk Downs. What is it about that racetrack?
Well, Suffolk Downs was very open and receptive to female riders, number one. When I started riding, here was already a half a dozen female riders, and then as in my era, as I began riding, and then the years go by, more and more females stepped into the jocks room, and as long as you were willing to work, you would ride. You know, we were accepted as an equal to the males. There was no we got every opportunity, the same opportunity as they did. And, you know, just the place, not only was it, you know, it accepted female riders, but it was home. I won my first race there. I actually won on my mother and father's first racehorse there. They've only had one, and he did real well. And it was a memory I won't forget, going into the winner's circle wearing their colors, having my mom go in with a smile and a grin from, you know, ear to ear. I started training there. When I was in between pregnancies, I trained with my first, you know, child, and I had my first winner as a trainer there. And then yesterday, I was the last racehorse to cross the wire. So I actually closed Suffolk Downs with riding a last place finish in the last race at Suffolk Downs, and I also got lucky to ride the very last turf race at Suffolk Downs and win it.
Damon, you mentioned a moment ago how Suffolk was so receptive to female riders, and you know, one of the reasons that I myself went there when I had the bug. And you've since been, you know, forced to travel elsewhere and ride elsewhere, and so you've seen the differences. Why is that? Why was Suffolk so receptive to female riders?
I think, you know, because everybody had talked highly about it. I'm from there, so, I mean, that's why I was there. But when you go somewhere else to ride and you say, yeah, you know, the girls really do good and they like the girl riders in Boston, more and more girls would come. Not only that, but say you're a bigger girl. The weight allowances and the apprentice weight allowance in Boston, it wasn't 10.75. It was a solid 5 pounds. So that actually brought in a lot of riders also that were on the bigger side. So I think some of the girls that were on the bigger side found it easier, and other riders, you know, men too, found it easy to come to Boston. If when you're starting off as an apprentice, you only have to, you know, you only have the 5 pounds versus 10.
Well, tell us when you
think, you know.
When you first started out, Sammy, did you have a weight problem, or was it easy for you?
You know, no, I started off, no, not actually having a weight problem. I was about 106 pounds, because I was 18 years old. Well, actually, when I was younger, I was heavy. At 14, 15, 16, I weighed about, believe it or not, I weighed about 149 pounds. And I wasn't, like, portly looking. I was just a solid 149 pounds. But the people that introduced me to the thoroughbreds, their wife was a nurse practitioner, and she says, you know, you might want to see a endocrinologist because you have a very thick, you know, a thick neck. It's, you know, you got bulging of the neck, and she says you might have a thyroid issue, and this is at, like, you know, 15 years old, 16. So when I, you know, went to the doctor, and sure enough, I did have a thyroid, and within 6 months of being put on thyroid medication and having, I actually had radiation treatment first and then thyroid medication, I went from weighing 149 pounds to 106. So as an apprentice, I weighed 106. I struggled to tack 108, but I was pretty good. But once I got older, then the weight would creep up. You know, so from my years after being an apprentice, yeah, I have to say I've worked at my weight, you know, so. But I would try to eat properly, you know, try to find the right diet that worked best for me, just so that, you know, I could have a strong finish and not be weak.
So starting out for you, once, thank God you got your thyroid under control, your weight was normal, and so for you, what appealed to you about the racetrack? Obviously, your parents were somewhat involved if they had a racehorse of their own that you rode, but how are you introduced to the sport?
Well, Christina, my parents didn't step into the racehorses until, gosh, I want to say 99, 2000, they got their racehorse. So, you know, from 1985 to that point, I accidentally fell into the racehorse world. I started babysitting when I was 10, 11 years old for many different people. And one of the people that I babysat for are the family that I borrowed their horse trailer and I did stalls from, you know, and I do the stalls for them. I use the horse trailer and, you know, and they, you know, let me use the horse trailer in exchange for, you know, the stalls or babysitting one way or another. Cause I didn't have a horse trailer for the horse that my aunt had bought me. The stipulation I paid for everything. So my babysitting jobs, I may pay for the grain, the feed, and things like that. My parents, of course, they helped out with the other bills, the shoeing and the vet. But as for the trailer, once I started working for the family that had, you know, that had the young boy that I babysat and I could use their trailer, they said to me one day, would you like to break some yearlings for us? We know you can ride, you know, we know you can ride. So would you be interested in breaking our babies? You know, I looked at them, I said, yeah. Any kid's going to want to say, yeah, at 14. Somebody's, yeah, that's more horses I can ride. I only had one horse. And I started breaking their babies, doing stalls, babysitting. At the end of the week, my paycheck, when you're 14, 15 years old, your paycheck is $300-$400. It's like, wow. I didn't have much time for my show horse anymore. And she wasn't a very good show horse anyway. She was a good pet, but she wasn't a good show horse. So needless to say, I dumped the show horse and stuck with the racehorses, moved in with the family because my parents were moving away, you know, from that town to another, from that town to another town. And if I moved, you know, I wouldn't be able to graduate. I wouldn't be able to stay near the farm. So I moved in with them, graduated a year early, and went on to the racetrack.
Graduated.
My show horse got sold to some people with some little girls and, you know, had a good home. And I just, I continued on with the racehorses. And what I did at the racetrack is I groomed, I galloped, and I brought them up, you know, to the paddock for other riders to ride.
So were you able to graduate from high school early because you were really good in school?
Christina, I can't hear you.
I said, were you able to graduate early because you were really good at school?
Well, I had all my credits. What I did is I got out the year before. You know, so I had started my senior year, but with all my, once my credits were completed, which was before the end, they let me step out of school, and then I went back for the graduation and graduated with the class is what I did.
So you're working at the racetrack. You're soaking all of this information in. How did you know you were ready to ride your first race?
Listen, I didn't. There was a gentleman there. He was a valet and an ex-rider, and he galloped horse. He was a great guy. His name was Paul Bohinko. And he came up to me one day, and I had just my helmet. And, of course, back then you didn't have a vest or anything. So just my helmet and a stick, and I was getting on horses all around. And one day I was standing at the fence, and he come up to me. He says, you know, Tammy, I've been watching you. And he says, you know, why don't you become a rider? And I looked at him, I says, and I seriously looked at him, I says, well, aren't I too big? He says, no, He says, take a look around. You're not too big. He says, you have a great seat on a horse from what I could see, and you get on a lot of horses. You know, you really should try riding. And he reached up on his helmet, and he took off a pair of goggles, because my helmet didn't even have a pair of goggles on it back then. And he says, he handed me the goggles here. He says, here's the first pair of goggles that you're ever going to own. Let's hope this brings you a lot of luck. And that from that day on, he put the bug in my ear. The next day, I decided that I wasn't going to be a groom anymore and just gallop the horses that I have at the barn and then go off. I'm done with grooming. I'm just going to go spread my wings. I'm going to go on a barn and say, I'm going to be a rider. What can I do for you today? And from that point on, once I turned 18, because in Massachusetts, you couldn't become a jockey until you were 18. You could gallop at 16, but you can't ride until you're 18. Once I turned 18, and that's when I began to ride.
Do you remember that first win at Suffolk and how it all played out?
The first race I was actually named on was a route race on the grass. And the steward said, we can't let you ride it. He says, we don't allow apprentice riders to ride the grass until they've had five winners. So I'm sorry, but you're going to have to wait on that. So the next overnight that came out, I was put on a horse called Go Darby and Joan. It's a horse that I was getting on. However, he was a first-time starter. The first-time starter that I actually track. So they again pulled me into the steward's office and said, listen, this is a first-time starter. I just ride first-time starters either. I says, well, listen, I know this horse. I'm the only one that's been on this horse. I says, I broke him on the backside. And I says, as for the gait, I've done all the gait. He's very, very slow. He's very good in the gait, but very, very slow. So basically they said, okay, we're going to let you ride them. And that was my first mile. It was a big field, a 12-horse field. He was a first-time starter, and he did. He broke slow. I don't know where we fell. I think we ran fourth or fifth. But then 2 weeks later, he was re-entered. I didn't ride a horse until he was re-entered. And again, he was a 12-horse field, but this time I'm in the one hole. Well, we this time knowing, you know, I know he breaks slow. He broke slow again, but me, I'm anxious. I just started sending. And I sent as hard as I could. And I scurried up on the rail, and there was a few horses in front of me. One of them was a journeyman. His name was Norman Mercier, known as Storm and Norman. And I weaseled my way up inside him. I mean, he didn't have to let me through, but I was going to drop myself if I didn't. You know, if I didn't take a hold, I wasn't taking a hold. And he knew it was me, and He opened the door because I was going to drop myself. I was literally clipping his heels like an idiot. So I won the race. I was all excited. They bombarded me with eggs, shaving cream, shoe polish, water, powder, you name it. My helmet smelled for weeks. But after that excitement and all the pitches, he pulled me aside. This is the gentleman that, excellent rider, won a lot of races. Norman pulled me aside and he said, don't you ever, ever do that again. He says, because you'll be on the ground next time. Mm. And I never forgot that day. My happiness, my excitement, that adrenaline rush sunk to the bottom. Like I was, they took, you know, like, you know, your mother and father scold you for the very first time. And I took it to heart, and I never forgot it. But, you know, I learned a big lesson that day, one from an experienced journeyman, one that I never forgot. And I was helped many times by many good riders through the years to become who I am today.
Who were some of those other riders in the room earlier on in your career?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you again.
Who were some of the other riders in the room early on in your career?
Well, male riders. Rudy Baez, I always watched him. He warmed horses really good. I mean, if he was, before I ever started riding, I always watched all the riders. I sat there. They all had, like, little nicknames. Well, Rudy Baez was always known to me as the stagecoach rider. The way he sat on the horse, the way he warmed up the horse, he looked like somebody riding the stagecoach with a whip. You know, he was a very strong finisher, had a great clock. And so that's, I fall, you know, warming up, I thought was very good. Gambardella, I love the way he rides. He could ride on the turf, the dirt, short, long, natural seat on a horse. Great talent. I love the way he sit. I loved his patience, and I loved his clock. The way I hit a horse, I practice my hitting. I watch Frankie Catrone. He could really pick a horse's head up, throw the reins at him, and the way he hit, it just stood out. So I try to perfect my hitting like his. So I took a little bit of everybody's style-wise to make my style. Now as for, like, women, you know, each woman was different. There was Jill. She was one of a kind. Great personality. Will tell you how it was, but was very honest. And I, you know, it seemed like if you were more blunt, more honest, you know, they respected you more. Marianne Bogachow, she was quiet. She didn't say much, but had a great clock. Sat quietly on those nervous horses. So I try to take a little bit of that, you know, and follow her way that way. And then there was Susie Kelly. She just didn't seem to care about much at all. You know, she was upbeat, outgoing, whimsical. And I always just say, aren't you ever nervous? She says, no. She says, and the way to fix that, she says, just take it like a morning work. Go out there, go in the gate like you're working a horse. How hard can it be? As long as you try your hardest and you do your best, it's nothing to worry about. You know, you did your best. And you know, that'll relax you. I've been blessed with a lot of friends and a lot of, you know, different riders that come out of there. And, you know, to this day, Christina, you know, I'll ask, well, you know, if I can learn something, well, what do you do to help this along? Or what is it that you do to make that horse break better? Or, you know, what do they teach you here and there? If I can learn something new every day, I'm a winner. You know what I mean? It just makes you that much better.
Jockey Tammy Pammarini joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Tammy, I do want to quickly speak about, you mentioned Jill Jellison, one of the most wonderful people in the world, unfortunately passed away at the very young age of 51, back in 2015 of breast cancer, and loved her dearly. She was very, very successful, won 240 races in 98, I believe it was, at Rockingham and that whole area. Just wonderful person. I want to give her a quick shout out since she's no longer with us and not able to be with us. Didn't they have a stakes race named after her at Suffolk?
They did last year, but they didn't have it this year.
Yeah.
I wanted to ride in it too, and I didn't get the opportunity to.
Well, I'm glad they had it last year at least.
Yeah.
So respected, respected.
She's a great person. You know, as well as I, she'd come in, oh, what the heck, blah, 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 this horse isn't doing good. Yeah, it's this, it's that, you know, it's not training good. Oh, I only jogged it a mile. It don't even feel good. She'd go out and win. We knew right there and then it's going to be a winner. When she talked bad about a horse and didn't like it, it just went on to trounce.
You're exactly right.
Every time.
When it first happened, I was new. I was like, what is she talking about? And then I figured it out. So for you, Tammy, like me, you are a bit on the taller side when it comes to jockeys. You're taller for a jockey. How do you fold up and look so good on a horse?
you know, believe it or not, Jill was taller than me. She was 5'5". I've actually shrunk. I'm like 5'2 now. But I, you know, my whole life I've been like 5'3", but I'm now about 5'2.5". But I don't know. I have long legs, but I have a very short body, Christina. So I look better that way. And I have, see, I have the long legs, long arms. And I always thought my arms got in the way, and my husband would say, no, that's your strength. You get to push them more and harder, and you get to reach up further, and you get to take across it. So it's even emphasized that much more because you have long arms. So, but I think me being short in posture, meaning from the waist up, it helped me fold up because I didn't really ride real short. I kind of rode level at the withers. And like I said, I watched Kyle Campbell-Dowler, and he always told me, you know, the longer you ride, the longer you ride. You know, you don't want to be riding too short, but it'll help with your balance, and it'll help with folding up on a horse.
I'm sure your days at Parks, you saw Tony Black ride, and he'd ride, his irons would be down to the horse's knees, practically.
Yeah.
He rode very long, so that's, I don't even know how old he was when he rode his last race, like 68 or something crazy. I don't even know.
Well, didn't he ride one last year?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I think it was last year.
Yeah.
I don't even know how old I forgot how old he is. He's crazy. Crazy. But, Tammy, we need to take a quick commercial break here, folks. Stay with us. You are listening to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judges' choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Hi, I'm John Velasquez.
And I'm Julian Lepau. Every jockey knows and accepts the risk of a sport every time they get a leg up on the horse.
Although catastrophic on-track accidents are rare, when they do happen, the lives of the jockeys and their family change forever.
It's up to all of us in racing to support these men and women.
That's why we support the Permanent Disabled Jockey Fund. Since its founding in 2006, the PDJF has disbursed over $8 million to over 75 permanently disabled jockeys.
Over 90 cents out of every dollar donated goes directly to these brave men and women.
They use their monthly stipend to pay bills, hire caretakers, and many other things that make living with a permanent disability just a bit easier.
This is Mike Penna of HRRN. Did you know that the PDJF has no permanent guaranteed funding mechanism and relies entirely on donations from people like you? Please visit the PDJF website at pdjf.org to learn how you can help.
Hi, I'm Ron Turcott. I support the PDJF. I hope you will too, and I thank you.
You're listening to Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
They race off the top of the turn and into the home stretch here, and they've got the gray to catch. It's Colonel Red in command, bearing down outside now. Here comes a run from Shackleton, and Shackleton confronts Colonel Red just outside the furlong ground. Driving third down along the inside is Tiz Wicked. Generalist is also in it to win it. Here's Shackleton coming clear in the late stages, and Shackleton is opening up by four lengths. It's Shackleton who set off the pace and pounced to win the sixth from Suffolk Downs. Dead tight there for second, a four-way photo. The long shot, Gallant Cause, Generalist, Colonel Red, and Tiz Wicked all involved in the photo.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host, Christina McManigal, and I am joined this evening by jockey Tammy Pamerini. Tammy, that was your last victory at Suffolk Downs this past Sunday. Shackleton won pretty easy for, I believe, Jay Bernardini, I believe it was.
Jay Bernardini, yep,
yeah,
it was.
Yeah. Now, I think he's based out of Ohio now, I want to say. He's on... He's on my Facebook. It's interesting to see how the Boston people have kind of spread out all over the place. Maryland, Ohio. Now, you're at Finger Lakes, actually. I know you spent a brief amount of time at Parks. Tell us why you went to Parks and why you went to Finger Lakes.
All right. Well, when I left Suffolk, we couldn't decide where we wanted to go. And, you know, we've ridden at all different racetracks, you know, several. I want to say around, you know, around 30 different racetracks we've been to. So we decided, you know, why not try where the money is? And that's where you were, believe it or not. At the time, you did very well. So I said, you know, there are some girl riders there. I said, you know what? I know some of the trainers there. So why not give it a whirl? I did very well, believe it or not. I had Joe Hampshire as an agent. And you, I don't know if you know Joe.
Oh, yeah.
He was originally from New England.
Mm-hmm.
And I hit it right off. You know, I was hitting it like 40% when I first started. I stayed there just a year because I didn't own the home there. And I decided that, you know, I wanted to go someplace that we could buy and afford a, you know, afford a home, have some stability, and, you know, a lot of racing dates because they started to cut dates. Believe it or not, the year I got there, they cut dates there at, you know, in Pennsylvania. So, you know, and it was moving around a lot. I just, you know, you go up, you know, you go here, you go there, you know, you go to National. It was a lot of driving around. So I figured, you know what, you know, I know a few more people. I know Groosmuck up at Finger Lakes, and it's a little more laid back. And, you know, the mass breads were up here. You know, mass bred races were up here, too. And I said, you know what, I just decided that, you know, I'm going to look for a house up here. It was a little more affordable. So I bought a home up here, Finger Lakes, after spending the year there. And I've been here now going on my fourth year.
Now, Joe Hampshire, that's a familiar name. Rode with him there at Parks, actually. We've had him on the show back in the day. And, yeah, I heard he had an accident. Is he he's still an agent, I guess, at Parks?
Yeah, he's an agent still, yep. He has Michael Sanchez, the last I knew, and I don't know if he has another rider, but I know he does have Michael Sanchez. He does a wonderful job, Joe does.
Yeah, I love Joe. But what's funny, actually,
he has a lot of business.
What's funny, Tammy, is that you have employed your husband as your agent for most of your career.
Yes.
Actually. Now, is he currently your agent?
He's currently my agent.
Now, how did that all happen?
How did he become my agent?
How did you fall in love? Did that all happen?
That's a funny story in itself. Well, the first time we met was, I want to say, back early 90s, late 80s. And I was riding at Rockingham on a Friday night because they had night racing at Rockingham Park. And you know, there was only a few places that would be open after the races were closed, you know, shut down for the evening. So I'm at this place that it was a bar type of restaurant, but it had two floors. So I'm looking down all of us girls would go over there after we rode. And there was, like I said, there were several girls. So it was Jill, myself, Linda Anderson, Abby, Susie Kelly, all of us. So we headed over to this one place, and I'm up above looking down. It was like, it's funny. It was like a circular. It was a second floor, but it had like a circular hole with a railing. And I looked down, and there was some tables down below. Well, it happened to be a young trainer, whom Abigail Fuller married, mind you, sitting down below that I rode for. So I took a piece of ice from my drink at the time, and I chucked it down at him, and I hit him. He looked up, and he says, "Hey, Tamsta," because that was my nickname back then, Tamsta. He says, "Come here, I want you to meet somebody." So I headed downstairs and I sat at the table. It was a little round table, you know, four seats. There was Mikey on my left and the gentleman on my right, what happens to be my husband now, and nobody across. And I'm sitting there and, you know, we're talking back and forth, blah, blah, blah. you know, because I've ridden, Mikey was young. He's the same age as I am, you know. He's now in his 50s also. So we're sitting talking. Well, my husband at the time, he looks at me. He says, you know what you riders need? He says, you need headsets with microphones. And I looked at him. I looked at Mikey, and I gave a look like, huh? And he goes, you know, like NASCAR. And I'm like, okay. He says, because then us owners and trainers can tell us where to be, what to do, when to hit. And I'm like, what the heck? Who is this? You know what? I'm like, I'm thinking to myself, who the heck is this a-hole? You know? I can tell he don't like women. So I went and I looked straight in his face and I go, and you know what I'd say? I go, sorry, it broke. He looked at me, I looked at him, I excused myself from the table, and I didn't see him for many years after. And then I want to say like 92 or 94 it was, I ran into him again. I was leaving the jocks room at Rockingham with my pit bull dog. And I'm trying to walk to the car, and this gentleman comes up to me. You know, not that I'm antisocial or anything, but that was more into my riding than anything else. You know, and at the time, I actually had a boyfriend. I had a cop as a boyfriend. But I'm just trying to get to my vehicle. It was a nice little Ford Ranger truck. So I'm trying to walk to the truck through the crowd as quick as I could, and this guy's next to me. How you doing? What are you doing today? Nice day, isn't it? I'm just trying to walk. I'm like, I didn't look at him. I'm just, you know how you try to avoid something. So I finally get to my vehicle, and I glance at him. I put the dog in the side door, the passenger seat. He sits in the front, and I'm going to walk over to where, you know, the driver's side, and he's over there, and he goes, you know what this truck needs? It really needs some waxing. You know, maybe me and Mikey Catalano could come over to your house and wax the truck for you someday. I looked at him and go, hey, yeah, right, okay, see you later. And that was it. Again. And then in 1999, so several years go by again, 1999, Mikey comes up to me and says, you know, Tim, I know you're single. You've been single now for a couple of years. You know, I have a friend. He's an owner. He says, you know him. I says, maybe we can go out for a double date. I says, well, who's this guy? You know him. You met him a few times. I says, I don't know who you're talking about. Well, come on in the tack room. I'll show you. Look, he's right here on the wall in one of the wind pitchers. I'm like, I still don't know this guy. I says, I don't remember him. And then, I got picked up, and we went out on the date. And believe it or not, the date we went out, it was the four of us. It was a gay night. It was a bar, and it was gay night, and the guys were hitting on them. So me and Abby were laughing in the bathroom, and I mean, it was still all right. We had nice food, and it was a great place, great music. We had great time there, had a lot of laughs, and went home. I didn't talk to him for like 3 weeks, and Mikey come up to me in the morning. Tam, he says, John would like to know. I says, who's John? You know, the guy we went on a date. Oh, okay. He says, he likes to know if he could call you. I says, all right, sure, why not? You know. So we went out on a second date alone, and we had lunch, and then we went to the movies. And he proposed to me right there in the movies. I thought he was joking, to be honest with you. And I said, oh, yeah, sure, sure, no problem. And we've been married 20 years since.
Wow.
When we first let them know we were married and changed my last name on the program, they were all like, oh, you're going to last a week. Oh, you're going to last 2 weeks. They were betting. Everybody on the backside bet how long we were going to last. Little did they know we were already married 6 months. And we're still going strong at 20 years.
That's amazing. And
yeah.
What a crazy beginning to that story and to your life. And what's even more difficult, I would assume, for a marriage is working together. But you guys make that happen. You do it so well. How do you?
When I got married, I don't think he took the book right away. I think it was like the second year he took the book. And I had told my agent, I said, listen, I says, my husband, you know, he's owned horses and, you know, he watches a lot of races. I says, he'd like to become an agent. And that's when Maxie took him under his wing and taught him everything he knew. It knew my, you know, my husband about everything with agenting, and then we went on from there. He's done an excellent job. Yes, it can be tough. We drive in together. We drive home together. He is my toughest critic, but my greatest rooter and fan that there is, you know. So, like I told some reporters the other day, when you get beat a nose, a head, a neck, you know, you always doubt yourself and you say, well, what could I have done better? What did I do wrong? What could I have done to get this horse across the wire? You know, was it me? Was it just a better horse that beat me? And he would be the first to say, it wasn't you. You rode a great race. The horse was just second best. Or, what the hell were you thinking about? Excuse my language. What kind of ride was that? And boy, we'd either have some celebration time or we'd be arguing all the way home, because let me tell you what, I really didn't like to be told that I rode a crappy race. I didn't take that too well, especially by my husband. But, you know, then we'd sit down and talk about it, or I'd give my explanation why I did what I did, and then he'd see it through a rider's eyes. Eyes that he's never really looked at it or heard a rider explain their decision, you know? And he learned a lot, and I learned a lot. And that's why we're a great team, you know? We're a solid, great team.
Jockey Tammy Pammarini joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Tammy, there's a really interesting point of your life that was really, really difficult for you, and it's amazing to read about and to see how you came out on top, and even while you were going through it, you were still able to ride some of the time, and it's just a fascinating story. So, tell our listeners, there was a time in the 90s you got really sick, and then it led to a bout of depression, and tell us the story.
Christina, it actually started, it all began in the late, I want to say maybe even 1989. And what happened is I rode the card that day, and I rode the first race, but I wasn't really feeling well. And I had a headache, and that headache, each race I rode, it progressed. And back then we had Dan, and Dan worked for the Bruins for many years. So he was like our color man, our massage therapist, and our go-to fix-it guy. He had everything. And Dan would, you know, he took my temperature with these thermometer sticks that would go across your head and take your temp. He says, you know, Tam, after I rode the first race, he says, you're a little hot, you know. You're about 99 and change temp-wise. He says, yeah, you know, here's some ibuprofen. Why don't you take these ibuprofen? You know, as long as you're all right, go ahead on with it. And so I rode the first, and then I rode the second, and the second, you know, this headache I had, I mean, I had never, ever, ever experienced the pain that I had. I mean, it was like an explosion went off in my head. I rode the second. The headache was migrating a little bit. You know, my between my shoulder blades, I could feel the pounding of the headache, not in my head, but also between my shoulder blades. And I come back. He says, boy, you're looking really rough, Tim. I said, yeah, I still don't feel good. He threw another tacky tape on me, and he said, geez, you know, Tim, you're now about, you know, 100 and change. You're about 100.6. He says, your temperature hasn't gone down even with the aspirin or the ibuprofen. He says, you know, you still want to do it? I says, yeah, I'm still going to go on with it. I says, I ride a really, really good mount in the fourth. I says, and it's for a great trainer, Paul Thornton. I says, and I don't want to miss that mount. I says, he can win. So I rode the third, and in the post-parade of the third, when they threw me up and I hit the saddle, I said, when I sat down on that saddle, the pain in my head, it's like the pain went around and circumference and pounded, and then it pounded. The same pain went from my head down my spinal cord, right to my tailbone, and then back up. And I was like, oh, my gosh. Wow. So I got up instantly in the tack, and I just stayed. I didn't even post. I couldn't post because the pain is just, it was so much. It's now not just my head and my shoulder blades. It's down my tailbone to my crack of my butt and back up. It's just going up and down and all around. And I was getting nauseous as heck. I said, oh, jeez. So I went out. I rode the race, and I come back. And I didn't even take my dip that time because I got back. I went in the bathroom. I went to the bathroom. I got a drink, wiped my face off, and I went in and checked for the fourth because that's the race I wanted to ride. And I went out to the post parade in the fourth, and I was nauseous as heck. I was nauseous again. I couldn't take posting. It was hard for me to jog. The light was bothering my eyes, but, you know, I knew she could win. I just knew. All I had to do was break. So she broke. I held on. We won the race. And I got to the winner's circle. I mean, I was so sick. I was crying. And they literally, three of them come out. They got me off the horse because I couldn't dismount. I couldn't even take the my feet touching the ground. It hurt so much. And they walked me. They basically carried me to the room. And they called the ambulance. My temp was 104 and change. And they hit me with Demerol in the ambulance, and the vomiting started. Now, I turned out I was allergic to Demerol, which I've never had Demerol before. So I'm violently, you know, puking my guts out. The pain with that, I had a gun, and I told him, if I had a gun, I'd blow my head off just to get out of this pain. I've never experienced it. So they bring me to Mass General, and lo and behold, they run a lot of tests, and it turns out I had meningitis. So I'm in the hospital. My kidneys and everything shuts down, and I think I spent 3 weeks in there, so... That was the start of everything. And, of course, now being old, you know, from that point on, I think it was 89 or 90 that took place, Christine, I'm not sure. But from that point on, it seemed like every year I got meningitis. Every year I'd have a fall, I'd get meningitis. I went on a vacation. I loved to water ski and barefoot ski. I ended up my whole vacation in a hospital up in North Conway, meningitis. It was just one setback after another. And every year that took place, it took, you know, by the third year, so it was about 92, the weight problem started because I'd have to come back and try to get the weight off because, you know, you're on all kinds of steroids to get over the meningitis and this and that. And everything else, and that's when the weight issue happened. And then I became, believe it or not, I became anorexic bulimic. And because, you know, the guys heave, so I said, you know what, I want to eat, and I'm gonna eat and heave. I love to eat, you know. So I became anorexic bulimic to a point where that went out of control. And then the sleep pattern had, well, becoming anorexic bulimic. You know, I kept that a secret from everybody. And I'd eat myself out of a house and home. I'd eat my neighbors that were my friends. I'd go in their house and raid their food. And I just do away with it after. And what happened is now my sleep pattern started to change. And when the sleep pattern started to change, I became delirious. And when I became delirious and couldn't sleep anymore and nobody could put me to sleep, hospitals included, I end up in the hospital with them trying to get me to sleep, and they couldn't find anything to put me down and out. I wouldn't eat because I'm facing anorexia, bulimia, and not sleeping. So that led into the severe, severe depression. And I became I'm basically listed as a manic bipolar depressant. I'd have the high, high highs, and I'd have the low, low lows. and to a point where I wanted to off myself and attempted it several times, you know. So, you know, God was with me and didn't allow it to be successful at either try. And this all stemmed basically from being sick and then being sick and being delirious and not sleeping. I had a past that crept up, skeletons that were put away in the closet while they came out. And these skeletons were hard breakup and childhood memories that nobody wants. And, you know, being sexually abused as a three-year-old by babysitters to being physically and sexually abused at 14, 15-year-old by adults, and then, you know, being beaten by a boyfriend that you call him your boyfriend, you think he loves you because he's beating you, you know? So it all crept up. And I just, that's what caused the whole mental breakdown. So needless to say, I was locked up for a long time. I was locked up at a hospital. Matter of fact, there's a movie called McLean Hospital. I was locked up in that hospital for 6 months to the point where the state was going to take over and you'd never see me again. And my mother pulled me out, and I went from that hospital to another hospital and was in and out. But what happened is they ended up doing ECT shock treatments. My parents agreed to it. They figured, you know, maybe this will save her, you know, because nothing else. They came in with the last rites at McLean. You know, I was 80-something pounds, not eating, not drinking, not anything. And they had me in a room naked, in a room that was probably a 3x4 room, or more than that, probably a 2x, enough to fit one of those cot mattresses to lay down in, that's it. And you know, they agreed to do the shock treatments, which is basically an electronic lobotomy of the brain. And they dual-sided me, and they did 4 or 5 treatments at McLean, and it kind of brought me to my senses, but it's very painful. And then I was home for a little bit and ended up somewhere else for a while, and then ended up somewhere else for a while. And they did multiple ECT shock treatments to the point where, you know, I ended up in Newburyport, and they had done some, and got out on a day pass, and I'd go and ride. Believe it or not, I'd go and ride. My father would come get me, and I'd go and ride, and then I'd be back by the evening, because that's when you're supposed to be back in the hospital room. Nobody knew that. Nobody knew where I was. So then once I got pregnant in 2000, it all stopped, everything. The bad sleeping habits, it's like I could sleep like a log all of a sudden. Everything changed when my hormones changed, and I've been good since. I'm not saying, Christina, that I don't have anger issues at times, which everybody does, because I keep them in for a long time until somebody, you know, pisses me off enough, and then I'll blow. And you don't want to be around me when I blow. You know, it's well deserved. But
wow,
that's what I overcame. I overcame a lot.
Unbelievable. I just want to put out there, Tammy, I want to write the script to the movie about your life. I mean,
yeah, like I said, I could, you know, I could write a book, you know.
You really could.
That, and then, you know, being, you know, having my children, I have 3 children. One's going to be 18 in October. One's going to be 13 in September. And one just turned 9. And I mean, they're all horrible. Well, all horrible. You know what's supposed to be exciting with you're pregnant, you're going to have your first child experiences? Mine weren't. My first child delivery was horrendous. It was 48 hours of pushing. I had a doctor that was on his 3rd straight shift. And, you know, I was having so much pain. And my husband says, is this something wrong? My wife can tolerate pain. She's busted her back and ridden with broken backs. She's broken this, broken that. She can talk. No, she just has a little pain tolerance. There's something wrong. Well, sure enough, after 48 hours, my stats dropped. The baby's heartbeat dropped. And I went into a state of shock, and they rushed me into the operating room and did a C-section. And lo and behold, she was never even in the canal. She was transverse, meaning sideways. I'm trying to push a baby that's sideways out of me. And when they cut me open quickly, they cut her nose. And they cut her from the top of her nose to just under her nose. And to this day, I give her all the credit in the world. She gives her credit. I mean, it gives her character. but she still has that scar from when she was a child and born. And then my second childbirth, turns out my son had the cord wrapped around his neck four times, and he was breech. So it was another C-section there. And then the third child, they didn't even want me to have. First of all, they said I was too old. I was 43 years old. They said, you're too old, and she has Down syndrome. They did the test. She has Down syndrome, and you're too old, and she only has two chambers of her heart. I said, listen, this is what God wanted my husband and I to have. I'm going to carry it all the way. I don't care if it's Down syndrome or not. I had to go to counseling. We had to put the counseling to let them know what's going to happen and what the baby's going to be like and prepare everybody. She was born, and we had her C-section, and she's a beautiful 9-year-old petite little girl right now that does not have Down syndrome, has all her chambers of her heart. They were wrong. You know? They were wrong.
Amazing.
I mean, yes, she you know, right now she's been recently diagnosed with as a type 1 diabetic. But here's a baby they wanted me to abort. And she is the most petite, sweetest, girliest girl you could ever get your hands on.
Now, I want to share with our listeners, we only have a couple minutes left here, Tammy, but I want to share with our listeners that I know with your second child, at least, you were still riding up until four months of your pregnancy.
My son, I rode up to 3.5 months. And then at Tampa one day, I had a horse flip. She had an extension blinker, but she was in the one hole, and she flipped. And she caught my foot and broke the top bone of my foot. So needless to say, I needed to, and that was hush-hush. I didn't tell anybody I was pregnant. So I had the foot looked at, and I had him looked at. I had the baby looked at to make sure everything was okay with the baby because I wasn't even showing. And that's when they told me it was a boy. And so that's what happened there. And now with Sophia, my last, I roll with her up to 4 months.
Tammy, we got no more time left. I'm so sorry. I hate to cut you off. Like I said, we need like 3 hours.
I know.
To talk with you. I hate to interrupt. Wishing you all the best, Tammy. Can't thank you enough for this. We'll have to have you again here on the show.
Anytime.
And good luck at Finger Lakes. You're currently riding at Finger Lakes. You rode two today, actually. So best of luck there, Tammy. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Christina. I appreciate it.
Folks, you can check out this show and replays of all of our other shows on the website at horseracingradio.net. Now be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Dallapina, I'm Christina McManigal, and thanks for listening.